When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, welcome back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. 1 week into this NBA season. How are you feeling, Mr. Beck?
Feeling pretty good. I feel like I've still got a shot at the championship. You know, the first week didn't go exactly the way I would have liked. But, you know, I need time still, Chris, to get my chemistry right and get in a good rhythm. But I think I'll be peaking at the right time. Thank you for asking.
I think you'll be okay. I, however, am feeling the whiplash from being ratioed by Charlotte Hornets fans this week. Let me tell you this. I was watching the Hornets and Nets game on Sunday in Brooklyn. And I've been a huge fan of the Hornets for a couple of years now, really ever since LaMelo got there. James Borrego was my preseason pick to win Coach of the Year. I stand by that. So I tweeted out on Sunday, late in the game, that the Hornets have become must-see TV for the first time really since ever. And the backlash I got from Hornets fans, from Chris Herring, SI's own Chris Herring, clapping back at me, pointing out that the Lonzo Mourning, Larry Johnson teams were fun to watch too. Okay, maybe I'm misremembering here. Those Hornets teams were good. I don't recall them necessarily being like, find them on, I was going to say League Pass, but there was no League Pass back then, finding them on the highlights or on sports talk shows, things like that. I don't remember that. This Hornets team with LaMelo Ball, with Miles Bridges, with their collection of young guys on the perimeter, Terry Rozier, this Hornets team is not only good, but fun to watch. But I was getting crushed, man, by Hornets fans.
Let me just say this. I absolutely endorse people on Twitter crushing you, and there was a part of me that was frankly gleeful about it. I was laughing my ass off watching you get crushed. But I can't believe I'm going to do this, Chris. I'm going to defend you. Because on balance, on the facts, you're right. Like, were there good Hornets teams? By the way, quick, just point of fact, if we're going to get... If basketball nerd Twitter is going to come after you for this, then I'm going to get even one step nearer. This Hornets team is not that Hornets franchise. This Hornets team is the one that was the Charlotte Bobcats expansion team that was god-awful for most of its existence and then eventually got rebranded as the Hornets. The actual Hornets team is the one operating in New Orleans now as the Pelicans, because that's the team. That was the franchise that had Alonzo Mourning and Larry Johnson and Glenn Rice and Baron Davis, and all the other guys. If you want to rhapsodize about the old Hornets, that team is in New Orleans. They're now called the Pelicans. I understand we now call this Charlotte team the Hornets, and I don't even know whose record books are whose anymore. That's how confusing this has gotten. But I will also defend you on this count. LaMelo Ball is fun as hell to watch, and if he is coming to my city, I want to go watch him. Was it a must-get ticket to go watch Larry Johnson and Lonzo Mourning? Were they good? But it's not the same as watching a passing wizard at his size and his abilities of LaMelo Ball. And plus, they've got playmakers all throughout the roster, as you noted. Rozier, when he's playing, Gordon Hayward. Bridges has been fantastic. Like, they're fun in a way that I'm not sure those old Hornets teams, as good as they were fun. So there it is, Chris. I've actually defended you, even though it was fun watching you get smacked around on Twitter.
Just roasted. We're going to put a pin in the Hornets conversation. I want to come back to it a little bit later in the show. Today, we're going to talk about the Lakers and what to make of their start, the Ben Simmons situation continues to evolve. The Pelicans, should New Orleans start getting nervous about the future of Zion Williamson, plus some surprise teams and players from the opening week? But we've got to begin, Howard, with the Lakers, who got the first win of the season on Sunday against your Memphis Grizzlies. And I watched that game, and I don't know what to make of it. Like, good that the Lakers got a win. Good that Russell Westbrook was more of a facilitator than a straight gunner. Westbrook, from the first quarter on, was looking to get his big men involved, specifically Anthony Davis and then later Dwight Howard. He was not, you know, having that hair trigger perimeter shot going. He wound up taking 4 3-pointers, but, you know, the early stages of that game, I like what I saw from Russell Westbrook. He did, though, shoot 5 for 15 from the floor, 1 for 4, as I mentioned, from 3-point range. So that is still very much a work in progress. Defensively, like, the Lakers have some guys that can defend you early. But one of my big takeaways from watching Memphis was Memphis, whenever they made the extra pass and got the ball out to a 3-point shooter, they were largely open shots. And in a way, I thought the Grizzlies kind of lost that game more than the Lakers really won it. I'm not trying to be critical of the Lakers. I'm sure Lakers fans will jump all over me for that too. But, you know, I mean, the Lakers needed Carmelo to go for, what, 28 in that game? How often is that going to happen? It was good that they got a win and got that out of the way, but I still have a lot of questions about where this Lakers team is going.
Well, yeah, and obviously, and it took a late closing push to get that win anyway, and against, it's not that the Grizzlies aren't a good team, but this is not exactly some accomplished, they're not a contender, they're not a big accomplished playoff team, they're not a super team. Like, the Lakers are supposed to be able to beat the Grizzlies without quite as much effort, but that's nitpicking at this stage of the season, considering where the Lakers have been over the last week. Beating the Grizzlies, any win, was going to be an accomplishment of sorts. I mean, let's start with Carmelo, actually, because it's like, no, he's not going to go for 28 every night. But it was a nice throwback performance, a timely performance, and a really fun one, too, because it put Carmelo into he's now ninth all-time among all-time leading scorers. And so that was just kind of cool to see. And I'm still not used to seeing Carmelo and LeBron together. Here are these guys who have been friends since before they entered the league, who've always wanted to play together. Here it is. It's actually, you know, on the human side, it's just kind of fun to see. And especially on a night that Carmelo was able to summon some of his younger self. But we're not going to see that most of the time from him, I don't think. That the last couple of years wouldn't suggest that that's something they can count on. So how are they going to win consistently, Chris? I mean, I think that's the real issue here is, can they play at a defensive level that they've had the last couple of years under Frank Vogel? Will that carry them on the nights that the shots aren't falling? The same questions we've had since they traded for Russell Westbrook, we still have. What version of Westbrook can be effective for them? How good of a fit can he be? I mean, I was listening to NBA radio earlier. Tim Legler was saying, listen, I know he's never going to do it, but he should come off the bench. He can still close games because stars want to close games. That's the most important part of this. And it's hard to tell a guy.
Howard, I think Vogel kind of quasi agrees with him. Like, you see Westbrook as usually the first star out in these games. So he's kind of doing the thing where he's starting, but then he's getting him out of there and trying to play him with different guys.
Yeah, because playing off the bench means you can be your usual self. A Russell Westbrook that is playing with no LeBron means Russell Westbrook can dominate the ball, can create a lot of havoc with his energy and his aggression and his athleticism. It's still, I mean, there's still going to be the question, as you and I have discussed a couple times in the last month, of what happens when you're closing games and what happens to your spacing. I mean, did you see how far off they were playing from him last night? I mean,
why wouldn't they? He's 1 for 11 from three to start the season, and that's not like an aberration. It will get a little bit better, but he is not a 3-point shooter.
And it's a problem. It is going to be a problem. It will remain a problem. Can you find ways around it? I'm sure you can, but you know, I wasn't one to panic when the Lakers lost their first couple of games. I'm not one to say that things are solved just because they beat the Grizzlies last night. I think this is going to be what we're all in for, what fans are in for, what media is in for, what everybody is in for. It's going to be a bit of a bumpy ride, at least for the first month or two, while they figure this out and while they get some guys healthy.
I think equally concerning, though, is the defense. As we record this on Monday afternoon, they're 22nd in the NBA in defensive efficiency, and this was a concern coming into the season. They just don't have the defensive horses to be an elite defensive team. And look, Rob Pelinka basically put it on Frank Vogel and said the Vogel effect will make this team better defensively, because Vogel has, he's had a good defensive philosophy in his 2 years with the Lakers. They've been a high-level defensive team. But I'm watching the game last night, and just before tip-off, I'm streaming the Lakers broadcast, and they're noting that, like, Kent Bazemore is the de facto defensive stopper. They're going to put him on the top wing defenders that are out there. No disrespect to Kent Bazemore, a very good player, but I never thought of him as this defensive stopper out there on the floor. And the minutes he had against Ja Morant, he wasn't a defensive stopper. Ja Morant went crazy in that game against the Lakers. So ultimately, it's going to come down to high-level defensive players. And whether it's Westbrook, I mean, DeAndre Jordan is a pretty good shot blocker at this stage, but not great at some of the other areas of defense. The guys they have coming off the bench are not great defensive players. You know, at some point, that's going to be problematic. And this team just isn't good enough to overcome being the 22nd best defense in the NBA, not if you're going to compete at a championship level.
Well, look, perimeter-wise, I think they've got some decent defense. Like, Bazemore's always been a pretty good defender. Ariza, when he gets healthy, is a good defender, though with a lot of miles on him. There aren't a lot of other guys. I mean, you know, when LeBron wants to lock in, he will. But you can't expect that for 82 games of a regular season at his age. And, you know, Westbrook's never been a defender. I mean, who else? Avery Bradley's been a good defender for times in his career, but
think about that, Howard. Like, opening night, Avery Bradley and our friend Bill Oram wrote a good piece about this over at The Athletic. Like, Avery Bradley was, like, on a layover in L.A. when he found out the Lakers had claimed him. The next day, he's in the rotation getting minutes for the Lakers because he is a defensive-minded player. That, to me, exemplifies how desperate Frank Vogel was to get a defensive-minded guy in the game.
Well, it's like last year, you know, Knicks fans were apoplectic about Elfrid Payton, but Tibbs kept putting him out there because he was the only point guard who would defend consistently. And that's going to be what Avery Bradley is for a lot of Laker games, probably. He only played 2 minutes against the Grizzlies. I'm not sure why that was. But I think, you know, listen, in today's NBA, you know, a lot of this has to do with, you know, do you have enough basket protection that everybody else has a little bit of a safety cushion? And for the Lakers, DeAndre Jordan is, I mean, what are we on? Like, year five of DeAndre Jordan is already shot? Like, and they're starting him. He only played 14 minutes. He's not playing starter minutes. But how long can you go with him still being the starter? Dwight, with all the miles on him, you probably don't want to start and extend him too far. I think this may just come back to, if you want to be an elite defensive team, you got to do what we've all been saying for the last couple of years anyway, which is your best lineups are Anthony Davis at center. And, you know, maybe they just need to be, you know, getting there sooner or even starting that way. I know it's not what Anthony Davis wants, but if the Lakers are going to be an elite defensive team again, feels like that's where this has to go.
How about Dwight and AD having a physical altercation on the sideline in the second game of the season? Even Magic Johnson, whose tweets are, let's just say, less than insightful at times, you know, came out and said, in my 40-plus years with the Lakers, I've never seen anything like that. It's one thing for that to happen, like, midseason, dog days, team struggling. The second game of the season, Howard, and they're battling on the sidelines physically. That's wild.
That was something. I love the fact that immediately afterwards, no big deal. We just had a bit of a disagreement. We've squashed it already. Do you remember the last time that Dwight Howard had a major public disagreement with a fellow Laker? That was with Kobe
Bryant. Yeah.
And that one they tried to pretend was no big deal and made jokes about it and posted a jokey photo about it. But we learned through... It was a serious problem. It was a serious problem. So I'm not about to just take Dwight's word for it when he says we're fine.
No, I agree. All right, let's talk about the ever-evolving Ben Simmons situation in Philadelphia. The latest update is that Ben Simmons has spoken to the 76ers. He has spoken to the guys in the locker room. They had something of a clearing the air conversation over the weekend. But Ben Simmons is still not ready to return. Initially, there was some chatter about him having a back injury. Now it has kind of transitioned, pivoted to mental health at this point, where Ben is telling the team he's not mentally ready to return to Philadelphia. I would say this, Howard. It feels like they're in a better place now than they were when we recorded this podcast a week ago. I mean, players in media sessions are starting to defend Ben Simmons. You saw Joel Embiid addressing the Philadelphia crowd over the weekend on the Sixers home opener, saying, look, support Ben. He's still our brother. So it feels like they're in a better place. I still don't know how this all plays out. Does Simmons come back in a week, 2 weeks? Is he the same Ben Simmons? Is the situation resolvable with the team? Those are questions I don't have the answer to, but it does feel like they've moved to a better place than they were when training camp opened.
In the locker room, yes. As an organization, I would say no, because we also had in that same span of time that we had Joel Embiid, and I thought it was great what Joel Embiid did. That was a class move. When you take the microphone pregame to do your welcome back fans thing at the start of every season, that's usually just like, hey, we really appreciate you. Let's have a great year, blah, 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 and you walk away. That Joel Embiid went out of his way to mention Ben and say, this is still our brother, and be good to him. He didn't have to do that. That was a class move. I loved it, and I think it was genuine, and I think that it lays the groundwork for if Ben Simmons does decide to play for this team again while they try to resolve the trade demand, he could go back and maybe Joel Embiid has calmed the waters a little. Maybe what Tobias Harris said about supporting Ben Simmons calms the waters a little. Because, you know, you can embrace him in the locker room, but he still could get just destroyed by the Sixer fans unless you have kind of coaxed them as a team to go easier on him. And I think they're trying to do that. I think they're trying to make this as palatable as possible for Ben Simmons to come back into the fold and play for them in the short term until they can find the right trade. But Daryl Morey, within that same period of time, is on radio in Philly saying,
well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. The Daryl Morey radio interview with the Fanatic in Philly. Daryl basically laid down the gauntlet. He said nothing is going to happen anytime soon. He revealed that the only kind of deal he can make for Ben Simmons involves role players. And as we've both been reporting, others have been reporting, he's not doing a deal unless it brings back a star caliber player. So Daryl effectively pulled back the curtain on all that's been reported and essentially confirmed it, that this situation was not going to get resolved unless Philadelphia can get a big time player back in return for Ben Simmons. What did you think of the interview Daryl did, and was it smart to kind of come publicly out in this position?
I mean, it was fascinating because you and I both know, like, it's not necessarily surprising that Daryl was this vocal and this definitive about it publicly, but most GMs will not go to this extent. So I'm not going to criticize it. I appreciate the fact that he's candid about where they stand and why. And by the way, it's the right message overall. Should it be broadcast publicly? I don't know. I don't know if that's the best thing for the organization, whatever. But it's definitely the right message to the league and to Ben Simmons' camp. So to Ben Simmons' camp, guys, I'm not doing this until I get the deal that I think is fair for us. I value your client enough that I believe I should get a better return. That's the right message to send to his camp. No matter what shenanigans you're trying to pull, no matter what passive-aggressive stuff you're doing, we can talk about the mental health aspect of this in a minute. Let's put a pin in that. But whatever else you're doing in terms of his circle, the way you're handling the situation, rest assured, I'm not going to be forced into making a bad trade. That's the right message to send to them. And it's the right message to send to the other 29 teams that I'm not taking your flotsam for a guy who in recent past has been all NBA and will be again. So stop offering me, like, you know, your fourth starter, two bench guys, and a distant first round pick. That's the right message. Whether he should be saying that on radio and kind of like stoking things even more in terms of just the tensions, people can debate that part of it. It doesn't really bother me. I will err on the side of wanting candor every time. What'd you think?
No, I thought it was the right message to send, and he could not have been more clear that this was the way the organization is going to go. Now, one of my questions that I had after that was, does Sixers ownership, specifically Josh Harris, like have his back on that? Like, nobody believes it's going to go 4 years. That's posturing.
No.
But is Sixers ownership willing to go an entire season of being this uncomfortable, especially if it's a season where Embiid plays like the MVP, where Tobias Harris has another year like he did last year, where Tyrese Maxey takes a step forward? That's more my question. I don't think anyone's ever doubted that Daryl has the appetite to be uncomfortable for as long as it takes to be uncomfortable. I do wonder if Sixers ownership, who have been part of the process in the past, who have experienced the lowest of lows with this team, is going to kind of allow him to do that. Or at some point, are they going to say, look, we got to end this. We can get 50 cents on the dollar for Ben Simmons. Let's get it, and let's hope that those pieces can lead us to a championship. That's something I'm still unclear of, Howard.
You know, it's funny because my first instinct would be to say, no, listen, this ownership group, they brought in Daryl. They've obviously entrusted him with this. They're going to, of course, they'll back him. They know what the value of Ben Simmons is. They wouldn't want to get pennies on the dollar back either. But then I remember that this is the same ownership group that absolutely supported the idea of the process and hired Sam Hinkie specifically for it and backed him to the hilt right up until the day that they didn't and threw him overboard. So do I trust that ownership group to be consistent and back its front office and the stances of its front office, the strategic maneuverings of its front? No, I mean, they've got a pretty checkered past where it regards supporting their front office, to say the least. So, you know, and they threw Brian Colangelo overboard at the first sign of trouble too. I mean, I'm not suggesting in any way, shape, or form they would do it, that they would throw Daryl overboard.
A little bit, that Colangelo was a little bit different.
But we don't need to relitigate that one. There was a scenario in which they could have actually stuck by him. I'm not saying they should have, but they were as soon as they saw a sign of trouble, it was like, well, we're out. And then, of course, there was all their wishy-washiness about, in the wake of the Colangelo ousting, about, is it Elton Brand? Is it Brett Brown? Is it both of them? Oh, no, it's a collaboration. They've made a mess of things multiple times. So I guess my point is, I don't have a ton of faith in the ownership group. I do believe that this will be resolved when Daryl Morey gets the deal that he's looking for. It may not be the exaggerated version we've seen out on Twitter and other reports about, like, he wants 17 all-stars and 52 first-round picks and whatever. It's probably not that. He's overplaying the demands in order to get the deal he wants, of course. Just like he's exaggerating in saying, I'm prepared to go 4 years. He's not going to go 4 years. But the message to everybody else is clear. We need the right deal. And the message is clear to Ben Simmons. Get your ass in the gym and start playing basketball.
Yeah, I think that's...
Can we talk about the mental health part of it, since I said get your ass back in the gym?
Yeah. Go ahead. What do you got?
Well, I thought Ryan McDonough, who we both know well, obviously former GM of the Suns and worked for years for the Celtics. Ryan, his tweet thread on this, I thought, resonated with me. He says, mental health is a serious issue and deserves to be treated as such. So for Ben Simmons to try to force a trade this offseason, then skip the first few weeks of training camp and preseason, then show up in Philly but refuse to participate in 76ers team activities, then claim he can't because of back tightness, but now say he isn't mentally ready to play, is disrespectful to anyone with legitimate health issues. Ben and his group may think trying to exploit CBA loopholes to make sure he gets paid while attempting to force a trade is a fun game, but the NBA's league office and the other 29 teams aren't amused by it. And he says this continues to damage Ben's trade value, which increases the chances of him being stuck in Philly. I feel like I agree with all of that, and I want to make a little carve out here. It's possible that whether it's because of the way last season ended and the backlash from fans, or whether Ben Simmons just has other things going on, there is the absolute possibility that there is a mental health issue here that is legitimate. I do not want to dismiss that out of hand and say this is just a bunch of BS maneuvering by him and his camp. But it certainly feels that way based on all the facts that preceded it. And if so, that's a really cheap play of your hand. And it is disrespectful to people with serious mental health concerns. And for people to start just using that as another ploy when you're unhappy with your situation would be incredibly cynical and kind of gross. So I hope that's not the case. But we don't know, and we should always stipulate when we don't know. We don't know how much of this is truly about his mental state versus the fact that he's just pouting about not getting traded yet.
Yeah, I don't know either. And it is a, it's a tricky thing, right? Because you don't want to challenge a guy who might have a legitimate mental health issue, because we have evolved to a point where we are justly comparing a mental health issue to a broken limb or a torn ligament or things like that. It's a very serious thing. But if this is just the next ploy in Ben Simmons' attempt to get out of Philadelphia, that's not cool. That's not cool. And it has a trickle-down effect, because you'll, if it turns out he gets traded next week and he's in the lineup and he's averaging whatever, like, then it's just going to be, you give license to teams that don't want to give guys mental health breaks, that maybe see a similar situation and treat it differently because of how this is playing out. But we'll see. I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about next week as this situation keeps unfolding. Have you been watching much Pelicans basketball this season, Howard? Because they're pretty bad. Pelicans winless at the time of us recording this podcast. On Friday, they went into Chicago and got tattooed by the Bulls. Lonzo Ball had a triple-double. Maybe they should try to get guys like that on their team. The second unit for the Pelicans has been really bad. Willie Green has said as much. Zion Williamson is still not playing, still dealing with the foot injury that he had, unbeknownst to everybody, had off-season surgery on, and is still recovering from that. As far as I know, not doing a lot of heavy on-court activity, so we're probably still a ways away. Yeah, I guess to spin forward a little bit, Howard, like, do the Pelicans have to start getting worried about the future of Zion Williamson?
I'm not sure there's anything that they shouldn't be worried about. Like, they should just be worried about everything. Like, everything. I'd be worried about Zion's future in the sense that they're so bad without him that you have to wonder if they're going to be even decent enough with him for him to feel like there's a path forward here. So there's the contractual looming whatever decisions that have to be made. Yes, nobody in the modern history of the NBA has turned down, since the advent of the rookie scale, no one turns down their first max extension coming off their rookie deal. No one.
Just explain that for a second here for people that are... I'm sure people have heard that before, but the reason that players don't turn down that max level extension is because... you're never going to, if you turn it down and you sign the qualifying offer, that's money you'll never get back. It's not a situation where you sign a shorter term deal that you leave money on the table on the back end. If Zion Williamson signs the qualifying offer, and I'm just kind of ballparking this here, his qualifying offer number will be around $17, $18 million, something like that, based on the current scale. The first year of a long-term max contract will be like $30 million or something like that. So you're leaving a significant amount of millions on the table, and guys just never do that. Some threaten to do it. I know Porzingis threatened to do it a couple of years ago with the Knicks. Ultimately, they don't decide to do it. But, you know, somebody eventually is going to do it, Howard. Like, somebody is going to say, you know what, I don't want to be in this situation so much. I am not signing the contract extension after year three, which is after this season, and after year four, I am going to walk as a, or I'm going to sign somewhere, try to sign somewhere else as a free agent. I think it's, what is it, year four or five that the, one of those years he becomes an unrestricted free agent after that. And somebody's going to do it. Some player eventually is going to do it. And Zion seems the most likeliest candidate of anyone to try to do something like that.
Yes and no. He's the most likely because he's such a bankable star that his off-court earnings could, if they're not already, dwarf his on-court earnings, right? So you have this built-in cushion financially if you're just an endorsement machine. On the other hand, Chris, he may be the least likely to do this because this is a guy who a couple of years into the league has already had multiple injuries to his lower extremities and carries a lot of weight and propels that weight with a lot of force because he's just got incredible athleticism. And so the strain on his body, his ankles and his knees and everything else that's already been injured and his feet makes him an injury risk. So the reason guys don't sign the qualifying offer and then go to free agency is largely because you want as much money as soon as possible guaranteed. And the rookie scale contract, while great by normal people's standards, is still a depressed version of your true market value. So your first 5 years in the league, you're not getting your true market value. You do in your second contract. And, you know, so that's the balancing act here. That's like the risk reward that Zion and his camp have to consider is if you sign the qualifying offer and you're injury prone and you're an injury risk, you might not ever get that money. So, you know, that's the thing. I don't think there's much threat of him going in the near term. But when you asked the question, when we were like just, you know, sending over notes about the pod and what we're going to talk about, and your question was, should they be worried about Zion? My worry actually is more, is less about whether Zion has faith in them to get this right, although that's clearly an issue. It's more about, when are we going to see Zion healthy and productive for an extended period of time? I'm more worried about the overall state of Zion Williamson physically and his health and his ability to lead this franchise or any franchise for that matter. I think the Pelicans have a Zion issue on multiple levels.
Yeah, I think that's fair. You know, foot injuries on NBA players are as frightening an injury as you're going to get. If you ask NBA trainers, medical staff, it's like what the ACL used to be. Now it's kind of foot injury. And it becomes doubly worrisome when it happens to guys that are pushing 300 pounds because you're talking about a lot of strain or a lot of pressure on an injury like that. So you make a good point about the injury history of Zion. He may want to get the most guaranteed money right now in the case of something disastrous, but that's a situation worth monitoring. What is he on, his third head coach in 3 years now? Yeah. Alvin Gentry, Stan Van Gundy, you know, Willie Green off to a slow start, though we're not going to start wondering about that at this point. way too soon. But you gotta show him something, I think, to make him want to commit to that team over the long term. All right, let's talk about surprises here. Team and player. Start with me on your biggest week one surprise team so far.
So I hope by surprise you didn't necessarily require this to be a pleasant surprise, because
You're a negative guy in general, so we'll go with that.
You're going positive on this topic, I know, so I'm going to go negative. We'll reach some
I'm a positive guy, you know. I'm known for positivity.
Yeah, you're Mr.
Parts.
Positive.
Absolutely.
The Nets. They're surprisingly bad. 1-2, close win against Philly, losses to the Bucks and Hornets, and those games weren't particularly close at the end. Durant looks like an MVP. That's the good news. The bad news is just about everything else, including James Harden, but we'll get to him in the second part of this segment. Their defense is bad. They look like they don't have any rhythm. Durant and Harden are just kind of like taking turns. This looks like a team with two great players. It doesn't look like a great team. And that's more than just missing Kyrie. Like, obviously, they're missing a big star, but you've still got two guys who should be in the top five in any given NBA season. And they're looking really uninspiring right now. And like with the Lakers, it's way too soon to start getting into to panic and judging what they're going to be for the whole season. But that's a really rough start for the Nets.
Well, their defense has been bad, and that's something I thought would be maybe not a strength, but they would be able to build on the improvement they showed at the end of last season when they were a pretty good team in the playoffs. They're in the bottom third of the NBA in defensive efficiency right now. That's got to change. I thought LaMarcus Aldridge would improve that, but they're just not getting the type of defense they need to win games. And I don't want to jump your play on Harden, but like, because I wrote this as part of our power rankings this week on SI.com, like, he's attempted 8 free throws through 3 games. He averaged 7+ last season. Now, we've talked ad nauseum about the rule changes in the NBA. You and I have both had Monty McCutcheon on this podcast over the last couple of months. The NBA is really cracking down on the Harden-esque moves that have gone on in this league over the last few years. Do you think how much of that is part of all this?
It's hard to say. Like, it's real easy to say, oh, well, the NBA changed all the rules, or they adapted, how they're going to rule fouls that are caused, drawn by the offensive player, you know, trying to get rid of some of these nonsense fouls that offensive players were manufacturing, basically. And Harden has always taken real advantage of those things. And, oh, lo and behold, three games in, he's averaging less than half of his usual free throw allotment. It's easy to just say that that's the only thing going on. And maybe it is. I'd have to go and look at play-by-play every time he's had the ball. How many times did he not get a call that maybe he would have last season? I don't know the answer to that, Chris. I don't know if anyone's done that exercise on film. I think that there's probably an element of it. But he's too great a player for that to be completely freaking derail him. And, you know, some fans have observed that he doesn't necessarily look like he's in prime condition. Wouldn't be the first time that James Harden showed up in less than prime condition to a season. So there's that possibility. He's also shooting 38% from two-point range, by the way. He's shooting better from three than from two right now by a percentage point. So you can't blame the bad two-point percentage on the rules changes with regard to offensive foul drawing, unless it's he's drawing all this contact and it's affecting his shooting because he's shooting shots that he thinks he should be getting fouls called on that he's not. I mean, that's also possible, but I think James Harden's just out of sorts, period, right now. By the way, one more fact or stat on this, and yes, my surprise player was going to be James Harden. He's only averaging 16 field goal attempts a game. Now, last season, he averaged about 16, but that was with Durant and Kyrie, and he was adapting. There's no Kyrie Irving right now. James Harden averaged 21 field goal attempts per game for his last five full seasons in Houston, and he's at 16 right now. So there's some other stuff going on here. It's not just the rules.
I do think that, I mean, he and the three of them only played together for like 200 minutes last season. They had a very limited amount of time on the floor. And Harden has made it a priority, to his credit, to become more of a playmaker than a scorer with this Nets team. Maybe he does need to go back to the old James Harden, just attack relentlessly and try to get to the free throw line. But I haven't gone minute by minute with Harden. I have watched the early Nets games. I think there have been a couple of occasions where, you know, stuff that ordinarily he would get the benefit of the doubt on, he doesn't anymore. And by the way, I love it. I think this rule change has been beneficial to the NBA. You don't have that same bullshit getting called where guys, you know, pump fake and then jump into opposing defenders. That's not basketball. That's not a basketball play. So kudos to the NBA for realizing it, addressing it, and I think making the game move a lot more freely. My surprise team, Howard, is my Charlotte Hornets. I know, Buzz fans, you hate me, you ratioed me, all that, but the Charlotte Hornets bandwagon is filling up, and I am driving it. This team is not only entertaining, which we touched on early in the show, but they are really good right now. They have six players averaging in double figures, and that is without Terry Rozier as part of the rotation at the moment because he's out of the lineup. When they're fully healthy, they are explosive in that backcourt. We know about LaMelo Ball. Terry Rozier has played great in his couple of seasons in Charlotte, but Miles Bridges is a straight stud. Two of the first three games, he had 30-plus points. This guy is the real deal. And when he and LaMelo start playing up-tempo, it's as good a team as any in transition this league. I mean, I'm not going to put them, you know, raising banner number one down there in Charlotte at this point. But this is a playoff team, and when they get into the playoffs, based on some of the improvements I think we're going to see this season, they're going to be a really tough out. I would not want to play Charlotte in the postseason with that group.
No, listen, we're going to wear out our Hornets love in week one here. But like, no, the Hornets are a blast, and Miles Bridges is a huge part of that. He's crazy athletic. It is not just in the open court. Like he was just attacking the couple games I've watched. He's just attacking guys off the dribble too. He's got tremendous lift to the basket. His 3-point shot's going. He was just named Eastern Conference Player of the Week. So yep, there's that. 25 points, 8 rebounds, 2.7 steals through week one. And there's nothing in particular, like the numbers may not sustain, but I mean, there's nothing in terms of his overall game that's not sustainable. We've seen this Miles Bridges has been kind of coming along like this since he got to the league. So they've got a lot of really nice talent there. I mean, credit Mitch Kupchak, who has quietly done, because that's what Mitch does. Mitch is quiet. He's the guy you will hear the least from among NBA GMs. But you know, not that long ago, Mitch Kupchak was run out of L.A. And I thought that was probably the end for him in this league. And especially, you know, at his age, you don't necessarily get another shot. The Hornets hired him. It was looked at as a North Carolina thing. Michael Jordan taking care of somebody in the Tar Heel family. And Mitch and his crew have done a really nice job putting this team together, both drafting and picking up guys like Gordon Hayward and Terry Rozier, all the Celtics castoffs.
Hey, Boston, looking back on it, would probably take Terry Rozier back in a heartbeat over the deal they made for Kemba Walker at that time. By the way, before we move on to the Hornets, like, can somebody give Ish Smith a long-term contract? The guy's on his 12th NBA team, and Sunday night against
Tied for the record.
Sunday night against Brooklyn, he was the best player on the floor in the fourth quarter. LaMelo Ball was coming in to check in midway through the fourth, and I think he said to James Borrego, like, let Ish go. Like, the guy's balling right now. Like, let this guy go. And he won the game for them in that fourth quarter. Shout out to Ish Smith for just plugging along and keeping that career going. Do you have anything else to add on Harden, or should I just go with my surprise player?
No, I think that's it. I mean, the Nets are not going to – we cannot assume that Kyrie Irving's coming back anytime soon. And we know the Nets have a bunch of really good players and a really nice deep roster, but none of these guys are going to carry your offense or create a lot of offense. James Harden, and whether it's his conditioning, whether it's adapting to the new foul rules, whatever it is, until he gets right and produces the way that we know Harden can – the Nets are going to be in danger of severely underachieving. So that the Harden factor bears watching. So who's your surprise player? And I'm sure you're going to go in a much more positive direction than I did.
Absolutely. My man, Jaylen Brown, off to a hot start with the Celtics. Now, Brown, I was working the broadcast for NBC Sports Boston on the Celtics-Knicks game, the pre- and post-game show. And Jaylen Brown, going into that game, he had been basically on the couch for 10 days. He had been in quarantine because of COVID issue. He was questionable going into that game. And he came out, Howard, after 10 days of doing nothing and scored 46 points in 46 minutes. Now, he had a clunker against the Raptors two nights later, which was kind of returning to the normal coming off such a situation like that. But the fact that he'd come off the bench in a double overtime game and score 46 points, shooting 8 of 14 from beyond three-point range, was one of the most remarkable performances in recent memory. Now, this Celtics team is always going to be Jason Tatum's team. Jason Tatum is the alpha on that team. He is the MVP candidate on that team, the guy that is eventually going to lead the NBA in scoring. But Jaylen Brown is slowly but surely closing the gap here. Last year, Jaylen Brown was an all-star for the first time. I think he'll be an all-star again this season. Last year, Jaylen Brown shot nearly 40% from three-point range. I think he's going to leap that and shoot above 40% from three this year. He's already, and has been, one of the best perimeter defenders on this Celtics team. So I like everything I've seen from Jaylen Brown. You throw out that weird Kyrie Irving year, the second year for Kyrie, which was Jaylen Brown's second year, and he has improved statistically in every single season. He continues to work. He continues to get better. And what I see from Jaylen Brown this season is improved confidence in his jump shot, improved ball handling, improved strength. I mean, against the Knicks, he went to the basket several times and just bodied defenders that were put in front of him. This guy is going to be a 20-plus per game scorer. He's going to be a solid B or B-plus level defender. He's going to make threes. You know, it's not that long ago, Howard, that Jaylen Brown was like the centerpiece guy in the trades that brought back other all-stars. I don't want to call anybody untouchable, but Jaylen Brown's getting close to it with this Celtics team. I'm not sure there's too many guys in this league I would trade a, 25-year-old now version of Jaylen Brown.
No, I'm with you. I like those two together anyway. I hope they can kind of figure out a better rhythm and a better way to play off of each other. I think right now the Celtics have, you know, the benefit of you know, one of the best wing tandems for sure in the NBA. I don't know where they rank in wing tandems, but that's a damn good one, especially because of their ability to play both directions and Jaylen Brown in particular at the defensive end. And if he's going to be, you know, an elite scorer too, I would not break them up, but I do think that the challenge for them and for Ime Udoka and his staff is like, how do you get these guys to maximize their individual talents and play off of each other in a way that opens it up for everybody else too? Because it doesn't feel like, I've never gotten a sense there's great synergy between the two of them. I'm not saying there's tensions or anything. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong. I'm just saying it doesn't feel like a 1-2 punch that's getting the most out of itself given their talent.
I don't know. I don't know if I agree. I mean, you know, like Tatum's rookie year, Brown's second year, they went to the conference finals. Like they've had some deep playoff runs playing together. I think the bigger issue is that I don't think they've been flanked well enough by the right kind of players. Like one of the bigger concerns I have with the Celtics this year is, are they going to get the kind of offense from the point guard position that they've had in years past? You think about it, it was Isaiah Thomas. It was Kyrie Irving. It was Kemba Walker. They've always had offensively oriented guys playing that point guard slot. Marcus Smart is an elite defender, and I think he's a developing playmaker, but he's never going to be that offensively oriented guy. So no. Who is that third guy to take the pressure off of Brown and Tatum? Does it become Dennis Schroeder as time goes on? Do one of the young guys, Romeo Langford, Aaron Nesmith, somebody in the front court like Al Horford, do they step up and play that role? Because you're a playoff team with these two guys as your centerpiece, no question, but you're probably like the 6 or 7 seed, and that usually will mean a first-round exit.
Yeah, I mean, look, but to the point, like, yes, they've had some deep playoff runs, but it's the guys you mentioned who were powering a lot of that. Like, this version of Jaylen Brown and this version of Jason Tatum, as these guys have advanced and improved themselves over the last few years, they are now taking on the majority of the offensive burden, and they have degraded at point guard along the way. So there is more on Brown and Tatum, and I think all the more reason why they need to be able to play off of each other, maximize each other, because there's just not a ton of other firepower there. By the way, before we leave the subject of just breakout guys, there was a couple other notes I had made. Tyler Hero, who everybody was wondering about last season, so far this season averaging 28 points and 8 rebounds. Maybe not sustainable, but that's a nice bounce back so far for Tyler Hero. And Ja Morant, man, averaging 35-8, 44% on threes. This stat from Justin Kubatko on Twitter: he became the first player in Grizz history to record a 40-point 10-assist game. That was the one against the Lakes. His 105 points are the most through the first 3 games of a season in franchise history, surpassing the previous mark by 26 points. So Ja Morant knocking on the All-Star game door already.
He's a stud. I love everything about that Memphis team. Ja Morant, Desmond Bain, Dylan Brooks. You go down the list. I mean, Kyle Anderson. They're a really good team. They've drafted well over the years, and they've built something I think is really sustainable down there in Memphis. Before we go, Howard, I wanted to give you a chance to defend your reprehensible decision.
Reprehensible?
To leave Dwight Howard off the 75th anniversary ballot. You are one of, what was it, 86, 87, 88 voters?
88
voters that were voting. What was that's kind of an arbitrary number, no? Is that the... reason?
It's a strange number, and there's a reason that I probably should. It's not my place to say. If the league wants to, the league can explain it.
That's fair. They don't like anything in the nines. Let's just call it that.
I'd be speaking out of turn.
All right, you left Dwight Howard off your ballot just briefly, so people understand who Dwight Howard was. He was a 3-time Defensive Player of the Year winner. He was a 5-time All-NBA center. 4 times he led the NBA in rebounding. For the better part of a decade, Dwight Howard was the best center in the entire NBA. And now, in the twilight of his career, he has pretty successfully transitioned into a valuable role player. I think the Lakers would agree with that. Having Dwight Howard as part of that 2020 team helped them win that bubble championship. And Howard, we talked about this in a video show that we did earlier this week, but I'm not just sitting here saying put Dwight Howard on. I'm telling you who to take off, and you should have taken off Anthony Davis. Anthony Davis is probably going to be worthy of a spot on a 100th anniversary team, but Anthony Davis is 28 years old, and you stack his accomplishments up against Dwight Howard's, Dwight Howard's are more impressive. They just are. Anthony Davis, in seven seasons in New Orleans, didn't take that team anywhere. He was an incredibly important part of the Lakers championship back in 2020. Maybe the most important, right alongside LeBron James because of how he played in that bubble. But Dwight Howard has a playoff resume of his own. The 2009 Magic were not a good playoff team. They were not one of the worst finals teams that we've seen in a long time. Dwight Howard carried that team into the finals. So I don't know how you as a voter, how dare you, leave Dwight Howard off your ballot for the 75th anniversary team.
I love your passion for Dwight Howard.
I'm not even like a Dwight Howard fan. It's just like the guy, I remember the guy being really freaking great for like a decade.
Not quite a decade, but really, really good for the Orlando Magic. At a time when the East was, it was okay. It wasn't great. LeBron was stuck on really substandard Cavs teams, and Dwight, the year that he took the Magic to the finals, he did get through LeBron, but it was a LeBron team with, you know, whatever, breaking down Zydrunas Ilgauskas and like Mo Williams, and I don't know, was that the Antoine Jameson year? Like, I don't even know. Like, the crap that they...
Do we need to run through who Dwight had in that Magic team?
No, but like, listen... Let me just say to this about that Orlando team that he took to the finals, and I'm not going to diminish what he did at all. And it's not that that was some like superstar lineup with, you know, Turkoglu, Rashard Lewis, Jameer Nelson, but what that team did with Stan Van Gundy as coach and Dwight as the centerpiece was establish one of the first true like, spread pick and roll, 3-point shooting, spread out the defense. Have one like this like he was a defensive phenomenon, of course, Dwight in the middle, but it was perfectly calibrated around him. They had the right roster around him, and no, it wasn't a great team, and they lost in the finals. And the problem I have with Dwight's career is what has it amounted to? And we get in these chicken and egg discussions or these difficult discussions all the time. You know, Carmelo Anthony is now ninth all-time scorer, never been to the finals, won conference finals. How far did he lead his teams? But ninth greatest scorer in NBA history is really hard to argue with. And yes, Carmelo was on my ballot for the top 75. Let me just say this real quick about the 75 list. The NBA did not ask us, the voters, compile the list of the 75 greatest players in NBA history. Greatest was not in the description. As per usual with the NBA, there was no real description or standards or any specificity whatsoever. It's, we're creating a 75th anniversary team. Here you go. Here's a bunch of drop-down menus. Go to it. And if you wanted to compile the list of the 75 greatest players, either in the totality of their careers, or some people say their best peaks, or their best, you know, whatever, we could start just tossing guys overboard left and right from the original 50th anniversary team, because a bunch of those guys would get obliterated by the modern players. Obliterated if you transported them.
If you like plant Kyrie Irving in the 1950s,
he's a 10-time MVP.
speaking of someone from Boston, Kyrie Irving obliterates Bob Cousy. Like, just,
obliterates
the way it is.
And Havlicek and Bill Sharman and all the rest of them. Everybody but Bill Russell. And there are a lot of guys who those old Celtics teams benefited just from being Bill Russell's teammates at a time when they were the only dynasty in an 8-9 team league. Eventually it might've been a 12 team league or whatever. So that's what makes this so difficult, is that we're comparing eras, which is impossible. And so, like most of the voters, I grandfathered in most of the top 50 guys. I threw out one. I did remove Lenny Wilkins in favor of Dominique Wilkins. And then I had 25 new players from the modern era. And based on the results, all 50 guys from the 50th anniversary team made it, which means that most of my fellow voters just grandfathered in everybody. And because of that, we can't talk about greatest, because Dwight would kill a lot of the old timers too. Now, on the other hand, Dwight at his position doesn't come anywhere close to the centers that are on this team. Akeem Olajuwon, Patrick Ewing, David Robinson, Shaquille O'Neal. Those guys are in a class way beyond Dwight Howard. I'm sorry to say. That's not said as an insult. That's just the case. And it also is relevant to the fact that Dwight, when we talk about him being the best center of his time, there were times he was probably second to Yao Ming for part of his career. But aside from Dwight and Yao, there were no good centers for Dwight's career. He was like a shoe-in for All-NBA and All-Star, because we were talking about a time when the center was all still on the ballot, and there were no other centers. that's not to diminish what he's done, because the blocks, the rebounds, it's all there. But it's not necessarily 75 greatest. It's not necessarily just totaling up a guy's points, rebounds, blocks, postseason awards, and then who has the most to put those guys on the team. It's never that simple in the NBA. And also, you want to see it lead to something. So a quick note, because I know
it did lead to something. Yeah. Like when he was in Orlando, they were a contender, you know, right up until it blew up. Like they were a contender every year.
They got to the finals once and they lost.
But they were, okay, yes, they did lose, right? But that's one more finals appearance than Anthony Davis had in 7 years in New Orleans. Okay,
Anthony Davis is a distraction. Like, I'm not, we talked about it in our Order on the Court video, which people should go check out. It's a fun new video series from me and Chris. Go check that out. We had fun with it. Anthony Davis is like this red herring, not to be confused with our colleague Chris Herring. Listen, Anthony Davis made it and Dwight didn't. I get that. Dozens of other guys, bigs in particular, made it. That if we want to start quibbling, it wouldn't necessarily be Anthony Davis who comes off for Dwight, is what I'm saying. Like, I'll take off, Dolph Schayes for Dwight before I'm taking off Anthony Davis.
But to your earlier point, like, I don't think you can do that, because I think you can't just start comparing guys from different eras necessarily. I think you, like, Davis is not exactly Dwight's era, but close enough. Like, they're both kind of 2000s big men. And I think Dwight's. Dwight belongs on a 75th anniversary team more because of the length of his career, what he accomplished. I mean, Dwight was a great defensive player, but he was a pretty friggin' good offensive player too, at least when it came to scoring. The numbers he put up offensively were really damn good. Never evolved into the type of big man Anthony Davis is, but big men didn't have to back then. Nobody asked big men to shoot threes back in Dwight Howard's days. So I just look at those two guys in particular. Like Davis, to me, Davis, when he's all said and done, because he's probably got 10 years left on his career, is going to eclipse Dwight Howard. There's no doubt about that in my mind. But for right now, I don't see how he does it.
Let me just say that Dwight as a scorer, he was great around the basket. He's a putback guy. He was a screen and roll guy. And at his best, he averaged 20 points or better in four of his seasons. So that's fine, but it's not like spectacular. 20.7, 20.6, dips to 18.3, bounces back to 22.9. That's his high point. And, you know, this was in a time when, you know, we were coming out of the era of Shaq and all those guys when you expected centers to be something more. But he never averaged beyond 22.9. And then in that second stage of his career, when the league started moving toward everybody running a lot of pick and roll, and this is when you could be most effective, suddenly he's rebelling against Mike D'Antoni. He's rebelling against the Rockets, and he's rebelling against the Hawks and the Wizards and every other team he plays for, because suddenly he's like, now I want to be a back-to-the-basket guy and I want you to dump the ball into me 70 times a game or whatever. He was such a freaking pain in the ass, and I cannot speak for the other 87 voters, and I didn't weigh this heavily in all the factors of Dwight's candidacy, but you cannot ignore that the guy's career peaked basically at age 27, 28, when most guys are still in their prime. He did have some injuries in LA. He overcomes those. But then as a period of time, while still in his prime age-wise, where he bounces from Houston to Atlanta to Charlotte to Washington and then to LA, five teams in 5 years, three of those teams were terrible, and they wanted nothing to do with him because he was such a freaking pain in the butt and so disliked in the locker room. Like, when we're talking about the totality of a guy's career, we're not judging just a guy's peak. If we were just judging a peak of a career, then like Tracy McGrady should have made it. You know, maybe Yao Ming would have made it, even though he had a very short peak because of injuries and the age he was when he first arrived in the NBA. It's the totality of a career, and Dwight drove his own career off a cliff. And while he has, as you put it, made himself into this nice role player later and won a championship with the Lakers as a 12-minute-a-game guy in the finals, it took a long time for him to accept that. And he still weirdly bounced from LA to Philly and now has bounced back to LA again. Like, there's something to be said for all of this stuff. I don't know of anybody else on that 75th anniversary team who had the kind of mid-career, still in his prime track record that Dwight did, where teams just couldn't wait to get rid of you repeatedly.
Well, I'll just say, I think when it comes to locker room stuff, I think the Pelicans might have issue with Anthony Davis, given that he just basically detonated their season midway through it, his final year in New Orleans.
When it was time for him to move on and wanted to be traded because they'd done a crappy job of building around him after 7 years.
I don't endorse
what he did, so I'm not going to defend that.
I guess my takeaway from this is you hate Dwight Howard, and I'm with you, Dwight. I'm team Dwight. Wouldn't it be like, I thought about this when Dwight and AD were battling on the bench, wouldn't it be great if this is what they were battling about? Like, you know, like if Dwight likes Snickers, like 75th anniversary, my ass, like, says something to him. Like, wouldn't that be great if that's what comes out of this? Like, I was better than you. I'm better than you now. Forget that then. I'm better than you right now. So, oh, good stuff. You can read Howard's complete breakdown of his ballot over at SI.com as well. Howard, good stuff, man. We'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.